here on VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Katie Weaver and I tell you about the latest cut in monthly food aid for Rohingya refugees. Andrew Smith presents this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. We close the show with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, international experts and rights activists are condemning a second reduction in food aid to more than 1 million Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. The United Nations World Food Program cut its monthly food rations for the group from $10 for each person to $8 last month. The agency said it was forced to take the action because it did not have enough money to support additional aid. The WFP had already reduced the monthly food aid to Rohingya this year. It went down from $12 to $10 per person in March.
Dom Scalpelli is the WFP resident representative and country director in Bangladesh. He said in a statement that the United Nations Food Agency was appealing for urgent support to be able to return to the full amount of aid as soon as possible. He said that without the full support, the refugees' nutrition, safety, and security in the camps will suffer. Abdul Kalam is a Rohingya living at Balukali camp in Cox's Bazar. He said the latest cut is a terrible blow to the refugee community in Bangladesh. Trying to manage their families, many will starve now, he said. Gwen Lewis is a UN resident official in Bangladesh. She said last week, "We are extremely concerned that WFP has been forced to cut aid for the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh." She added that the food cuts will be especially devastating for Rohingya women and children in the camps. "We urgently appeal for international support," Lewis said.
At least 700,000 Rohingya fled to Bangladesh from neighboring Myanmar in 2017. They joined about 300,000 others who had fled Myanmar security forces' attacks on their homes and villages in earlier years. The Bangladeshi government mostly bars the refugees from leaving their refugee camps. As a result, the Rohingya there are completely dependent on WFP food aid. The refugees live in small, temporary shelters made of plastic and wood in very crowded conditions near the coastal city of Cox's Bazar. The refugees say that the $12 in monthly food aid that each person used to get was already very limited, as they were forced to survive on staples such as rice, lentils, and oil. "Most suffer from malnutrition," they add. "We are not provided with any clothing assistance from any organization," said Kalam, the refugee who lives in Balukali camp. "As a result," he told VOA, "he sometimes sold his food aid to buy clothes or meat or fish for his family. After the food aid has been cut by one-third, we are going to face a terrible level of hardship from this month, the 42-year-old said. Abu Jafar is another Rohingya refugee. He noted that aid is going down while food costs go up. Prices of many food materials have doubled over the past 3 years, he said. There is no way to escape starvation.
Tuy Nguyen is a Rohingya community leader and human rights defender who lives in Cox's Bazar. Nguyen noted that the reduction of food assistance for Rohingya refugees is not just a matter of hunger. Nguyen told VOA it would lead to increased violence and crime in the camps, including human trafficking of refugees. Ultimately, we are going to be forced to make unimaginable choices to survive, compromising our dignity and future. This is not the way any human being should be forced to live, Lewin said. John Quinley is director of the human rights organization Fortify Rights. The organization works among the Rohingya. He told VOA that the food aid cuts are extremely harmful, especially for children. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
The area in front of Janet and Jeffrey Crouch's house in Columbia, Maryland, does not look usual for their neighborhood. That is because the Crouches do not have a grass lawn. Instead, they have some small trees and many native plants. Lawns are areas around a house or in a park that are covered with short grass. In recent years, support for replacing lawns with native plants has been increasing in the United States. The process is called rewilding. In fact, the number of Americans planning to turn part of their lawn to native wildflowers doubled between 2019 and 2021. That information comes from the National Gardening Survey of 2,061 U.S. adults. In 2019, the percentage was 9%. By 2021, it rose to 19%. Paul Robbins is the writer of Lawn People: How Grasses, Weeds, and Chemicals Make Us Who We Are. He said that most people would prefer not to have lawns, but they feel that they need to have them, or that they can't do anything about it. He added that many homeowners feel they should have lawns to please their neighbors. It can be costly to keep a lawn looking good and green. But the Crouches had to spend much more money for the right not to have one. People living in a house next to them complained to their homeowners association, or HOA. The neighbors did not like that the Crouches did not have a grass lawn. HOAs can make rules about the plants that homeowners in a neighborhood are permitted to grow. Many HOAs require grass lawns. The HOA ordered the Crouches to pull out their native plants and put in grass. However, they refused.
We knew we were doing things that were beneficial for the environment, said Janet Crouch. She told VOA that it seemed wrong to put in only grass, which she called an environmental dead zone. Lawns are called environmental dead zones in part because they provide no food or shelter for wildlife. They also do not support pollinators like birds, bees, and butterflies. Bee populations have been getting smaller in North America and may be getting smaller around the world. Ted Steinberg is the writer of American Green, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn. He said there are other reasons that lawns are bad for the environment. He said they require a lot of water and chemicals. Large amounts of water can remove nutrients from the soil. Steinberg said that after the water removes the nutrients, people buy even more chemicals to put on their lawns. Scientists say some of these chemicals might cause cancer and other health problems. Nancy Lawson is the writer of The Humane Gardener and Wildscapes. She is also Janet Crouch's sister and the person who urged the Crouches to put in native plants. Lawson said there are over 16 million hectares of grass lawns in the U.S. That means lawns use more water than any other irrigated crop in the country. The Crouches' battle against their HOA took 3 years. They say they spent $60,000 fighting to keep their natural garden. They won. Because of their efforts, the state of Maryland passed a law that lets people grow native plants instead of grass, no matter what their HOA wants. I'm Andrew Smith.
Andrew Smith joins me now to talk more about this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here, Ashley.
In your report, you explained that the process of replacing green lawns with native plants is called rewilding. Can you tell us a bit more about this term?
Sure. In areas with houses, rewilding means to bring back more plants or let more plants grow. The word begins with the prefix, with the two letters RE. In English, that prefix means to do something again. So, rewilding means to make wild again. Rewilding also means to help preserve large natural areas, such as national parks and forests, and give more wild animals areas where they can move around and live.
Is rewilding popular in American towns and cities?
It's probably only supported by a minority of people. But more and more people are learning about it. Some people are even using the expression, kill your lawn. There are now many sites on the internet about the subject, and you can even buy t-shirts and hats with the words, kill your lawn, written on them. And as we reported in another story, some western states, such as Nevada, where the weather is very dry, have even paid homeowners to remove their grass lawns. But again, the idea is not just to remove lawns. Like Janet Crouch explained in the story, the idea of rewilding is to bring back plants that support a variety of animals, from insects to large animals.
So rewilding lets nature do its thing, as opposed to requiring human interference, like mowing your lawn when it gets too tall.
Yes, and I'm allergic to grass particles in the air, so I never want to mow a lawn again.
Ugh, I have got a grass allergy too. Well, thanks so much for that report, Andrew, and thank you for joining me on today's program.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we continue the story of the 37th President of the United States, Richard Nixon. The year is 1969. Richard Nixon, a Republican, is in the first year of his first term in office. His biggest foreign policy problem is the continuing war in Vietnam. During the election campaign, Nixon had promised to do something to end the war. The question was, what? Some Americans want him to withdraw troops from Vietnam immediately. Bring the soldiers home, they say. Others believe the United States should take whatever measures are necessary to win. Expand the ground war, they say, or even use nuclear weapons. Withdrawing troops would leave South Vietnam alone to resist communist North Vietnam. Yet, that was the reason the United States had entered the conflict, to prevent the communists from capturing the South. Expanding the war would not be an easy decision either. Already, by 1969, more Americans had died in Vietnam than had died during the Korean War. For Richard Nixon, the war is a terrible test. If he fails, his presidency could end the way Lyndon Johnson's presidency ended. Johnson decided not to run for re-election after he lost public and political support for his war policies. Presidents have advisors, and Nixon's most important advisor was Henry Kissinger. Kissinger was an expert on foreign relations. He later served as Nixon's Secretary of State. Together, they tried many ways to settle the conflict in Vietnam. It took several years before the involvement of the United States would finally end. The American efforts were both diplomatic and military. Peace talks were taking place in Paris. But the Nixon administration started secret peace talks in Paris at the same time. The administration also withdrew some troops from Vietnam. Yet, secretly, it sent other troops into Cambodia, and it began bombing neighboring Laos. The Nixon administration also started bombing North Vietnam again. Lyndon Johnson had stopped the raids a few years earlier. Efforts to end American involvement in Vietnam did not begin immediately. For his first 8 months in office, President Nixon made no major policy changes. Then, in October 1969, he ordered the withdrawal of 60,000 troops. He said he acted to speed the peace talks. He also ordered American commanders to give the South Vietnamese most of the responsibility for fighting. Americans were happy that fewer troops would be involved, but many were unhappy that the withdrawal was not complete. Huge anti-war demonstrations took place in the United States in the autumn of 1969. On November 15th, several hundred thousand people protested in Washington. Nixon tried to explain to the American people why he was not ordering an immediate withdrawal. In his words, "It is not the easy way, it is the right way." In the spring of 1970, American and South Vietnamese troops invaded Cambodia.
"Tonight, American and South Vietnamese units will attack the headquarters for the entire communist military operation in South Vietnam."
Nixon described to the American public why he had decided to order the actions in Cambodia.
"This key control center has been occupied by the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong for 5 years in blatant violation of Cambodia's neutrality. This is not an invasion of Cambodia. The areas in which these attacks will be launched are completely occupied and controlled by North Vietnamese forces. Once enemy forces are driven out of these sanctuaries and once their military supplies are destroyed, we will withdraw."
Early in 1971, the Nixon administration decided to provide air and artillery support for a South Vietnamese invasion of Laos. The goal was to stop supplies from reaching North Vietnam through that neighboring country. South Vietnamese forces destroyed many enemy weapons, but they also suffered heavy losses, and many American planes were shot down. After 6 weeks, the South Vietnamese were forced to withdraw. Many members of the United States Congress were angry. They said the invasion of Laos was another in a long series of failures. Nixon's administration had said the United States was winning the war. Opposition Democrats in Congress said the administration was lying. Criticism by the American public grew louder as well. Demonstrations took place across the country, including on college campuses. On May 4, 1970, National Guard troops shot and killed four students during protests at Kent State University in Ohio. This is what Neil Young means when he sings of four dead in Ohio in a famous protest song that he wrote in reaction to the killings. President Nixon said again that the United States must not permit North Vietnam to take over South Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson had said the same thing when he was president. Many Americans had accepted the war, but as it continued and as more Americans died in Vietnam, public opinion changed. In 1965, 61% of those questioned said they approved of the war. By 1971, 61% said they did not approve of it. The official peace talks in Paris offered little hope of a negotiated settlement. Over a period of several years, each side made proposals only to have the other side reject them. President Nixon wanted to address the public's anger over the war, so he announced that Henry Kissinger had held 12 secret meetings with North Vietnamese officials. But those secret meetings made no more progress than the official talks. In late March 1972, North Vietnam launched a major offensive. In May, Nixon ordered increased bombing against roads and railways in the north. By the end of August, the communist offensive had been stopped. Yet many lives had been lost. The pressure to withdraw American forces grew stronger. For the next 5 months, the Nixon administration continued a policy of official talks, secret meetings, and increased military action. Finally, the president announced that an agreement had been reached at the peace talks in Paris. There would be a ceasefire, and negotiators from the United States, South Vietnam, North Vietnam, and the Viet Cong would sign the agreement. Under the terms of the agreement, all American and Allied forces would withdraw from South Vietnam. The North and South would be free to settle their conflict without interference from other countries. President Nixon announced the news from the White House.
At 12:30 Paris time today, January 23, 1973, the agreement on ending the war and restoring peace in Vietnam was initialed by Dr. Henry Kissinger on behalf of the United States and Special Advisor Lee Duc Tho on behalf of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. The agreement will be formally signed by the parties participating in the Paris Conference on Vietnam on January 27, 1973 at the International Conference Center in Paris. The United States and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam express the hope that this agreement will ensure stable peace in Vietnam and contribute to the preservation of lasting peace in Indochina and Southeast Asia.
Yet the fighting continued and would continue even after Nixon resigned from office in 1974. April 30th, 1975, marked the fall of Saigon, the South Vietnamese capital, after the withdrawal of American troops. The North Vietnamese had planned a 2-year campaign to take Saigon. It would take them just 55 days. Another foreign policy issue for the Nixon administration was China. Here was Nixon's chance to shine as a statesman. Communists took power in China in 1949. The United States, however, did not recognize the Communist Party government on the mainland. Instead, it recognized the nationalist Chinese government in Taiwan. In the early 1970s, the Nixon administration began trying to improve relations. It eased restrictions on travel to China, and it supported a visit to China by the United States table tennis team, so-called ping-pong diplomacy. Then President Nixon made a surprise announcement. He himself would visit China. The historic event took place in February 1972. Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai and Party Chairman Mao Zedong greeted the American president. Nixon and Zhou Enlai held talks that opened new possibilities for trade. The next year, Nixon sent a representative to open a diplomatic office in Beijing. After more than 20 years, the two countries were communicating again. They would not establish full relations, however, until 1979, when the United States stopped recognizing Taiwan. Many Americans were happy at the easing of tensions with China, even as the Cold War with the Soviet Union continued. Many were proud to see their president standing at the Great Wall of China. Historians would later call it the greatest moment in the presidency of Richard Nixon. In fact, Nixon might have been remembered as one of America's greatest presidents if not for a break-in at Democratic Party headquarters. It led to a history-changing series of events that came to be known as Watergate.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.